Everybody okay? A bit gloomy outside, but some of you are still shining quite brightly. I wonder if sometimes some of you have the thoughts I have sometimes that I wish where I was at a place in time where I could look back from this safe place in the future time and say, God, how did I make it through that? That retreat, that day, or those years, or whatever. When I was teaching that retreat in Thailand in August, where we were sitting, it's about 30 meters from the ocean, and one day I came there for a sitting with a group of yogis, and a little girl, a little Thai girl, she may have been three and a half, she found on the platform, the raised platform where we were sitting, a little tiny hermit crab. She picked it up, and she walked to the Buddha behind me, which was, you know, up high, where they are customarily kept. You really want to see the beauty, the artist's eye who creates a Buddha, you know, they're made to look up into, not sort of eye level to eye level and are not down. So she looked up at the Buddha for a while and reached up on her tiptoes and put the little hermit crab in the hands of the Buddha, folded hands of the Buddha. Such a pure-hearted, true-hearted action and, you know, emanating mind state. I thought of this 100-year-old monk that 2 years ago, shortly before he passed away, at a monastery in the Sagaing Hills near where Michelle and Carol and I teach with the Chaswa Sayadaw there, went to visit him with the Chaswa Sayadaw. He was blind and nearly deaf. You know, but we walked into the room, and it was such an envelope of metta, warmth, such an immediately easy feeling there. And one by one, we were introduced by our translator and this 100-year-old monk's attendant would then have to yell, because the translator's voice wasn't loud enough, you know, have to yell our names. And it was really a yell. Like, just, I thought, boy, if this eardrum isn't already broken. But that's the only way you could hear, you know. This is Stephen from Hawaii, you know, and then say, what, and repeat that. Kind of went through that with all of us there. And then he called us up one by one, and he'd take our hand. And the only sort of mind recollection I can have of what that felt like was that his hand was both cool and warmth at once. You know, the warmth of unconditional metta and compassion, and still really cooled out, you know, real equanimous, really at peace with himself, his failing or failed senses, and completely tuned in. It was like the lack of eyesight did not hinder him at all from feeling deep into each one of us, one at a time. It was like we were there for a timeless period. You know, it was certainly several hours, but it felt only like minutes. Before then, he again, once again, after asking questions and talking about his life, entire life spent in this monastery. 90 years of it. And then he did a blessing. One by one to each, came up, you know, and bowed as is customary. And his blessing was very simple. May you be happy. May you be peaceful. May you be free from even one unskillful mind moment. I saw this child put the hermit crab in the hands of the Buddha and thought of this power of this monk, his own purity, his own deep wish for each of us to be free of even a single mind moment that's unskillful. And I think my companions, you know, sort of all left feeling completely washed in mind and body, and my body just felt like particles in motion and this sort of metta awareness that was ignited by being in the presence of this monk. We're practicing to be free from even one unskillful mind moment. And yet without being attached to any goal at the same time. Last week was talking about the deeper level of satipatthana where the goal and the discipline, moment-to-moment discipline, you know, really merge into one. Just as in the voyaging journeys in the Pacific by the Hawaiian Polynesian Voyaging Society, they keep the vision of the island in mind, but in order to truly pull it out of the sea, you have to be so attentive. As one navigator once said in answer to a school child's question through satellite connection, I think I mentioned that last time, you know, first the child said, you know, well, where are you? And in the middle of this 10 million square mile blue wilderness. What are you doing? And he answered, the navigator answered, we're looking for an island. And, well, how do you do it? You know, do you sort of measure mile by mile? Do you, you know, is that how you assess it? Just try and get mile by mile? And this navigator said, inch by inch, nautical inch by nautical inch. Again, which a great metaphor for, you know, our moment-to-moment practice, not reaching any further than this moment as it arises, as it's felt, as it is a felt experience of reality, not filtered through concepts. So I've been sort of talking about the four foundations of mindfulness, but mostly through the first foundation, kaya nupassana, the contemplation of body, the body in the body, you know, which means nothing else, just awareness in the body, no third process, no I. The body as its experience and the immediate and mutual intertwined awareness of the experience of the body. And likewise with all other objects, because as we're watching the body, certainly feeling tones come up, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, and mental states appear in response, in connection with pleasant sensations or in connection with unpleasant or reactively as it moves from the simple presence of feeling tone to a reactive state of attachment or aversion or ignorance of neutral. And, you know, unleashed other mental states, our cluster of mental states may be there. We may be dwelling for some time, noticing those, because they can be layered. These mental states can be the cause for other sensations or sensation patterning in the body to appear. And, the phenomenon of them all, other things that arise, other associated mental states and their behavior and the understanding that this is all a very fluid process. Conditions arise, causes arise, and there is a moment's experience. Those conditions fall away, and that experience changes and falls away. New conditions, new causes appear. So understanding through observing the phenomena, not unlike how the navigator shamans, would read patterns into the chaotic weather systems, the turbulent systems, and they'd spell out, they'd create a map of the journey, where to go by understanding the rhythms and currents of the sea, or the rain direction, the rain style, like many, many different names for the rain that would tell what kind of squall it was, where it came from, whether it's associated with land, storms, or other systems, a break off from another system. And really, over centuries, had this extraordinary ability to find their way by understanding elemental nature in all its forms. And likewise, our chief navigator being awareness, equanimous awareness, equanimous mindfulness, that is simply knowing in the moment these sensations as they are, knowing there's causes for them to arise. And as they arise, these sensations may be the cause for certain other mental states to arise, and certainly feeling tone is there every moment. And other phenomena, memory and vision, internal visions, images, and associations. We follow the patterning without losing the mindfulness. It's a journey of discovery that goes deeper and deeper. And it's layered. We come to a place where there's quite a bit of evenness, smoothness, peacefulness. And then suddenly that the conditions for that might drop away. And the conditions for that might be the very depth or peacefulness, our joy that was experienced from the previous sort of purifying round of meditative insight and presence. I'm going to address that tonight, how we do go through different layers, and the mind can get reactive. We can become doubtful, think we're losing it, regressing, and how to recognize that as just a holding pattern. How to be patient with that and know that those conditions too will fall away and change, and new arisings will appear. The Buddha put such emphasis on this first foundation of body mindfulness, calling it a delightful place to dwell in awareness. Many different phrases implying the delight or joy of being, of inhabiting our bodies with full awareness, with full mindfulness. He once described this process of practice. I think I already mentioned this. Is, all the rivulets of joy and delight and happiness and contentment, like the rain in the back of a valley, kind of coming together and flowing out to sea, the sea of liberation. And that we should think of practice that way, you know, of gathering these delightful mind states, joyous mind states, some of them coming right out of the depths of dukkha experience, you know, where we think we would never find joy in such mental or emotional pain, but the very patience and the very honing of our awareness and courage and confidence in going through that reveals our very deepest, purest desire. Like that, like the 100-year-old monk or like the little girl. It's interesting that the word raga in the Pali, meaning lust, you know, often associated with sensual attachment or chasing after sensual pleasures. Same word is conjoined with the word dhamma, passion for dhamma. You know, pure desire for dhamma and all its elements, you know, from metta and compassion to wisdom and understanding and energy, all the way to liberation. Where does that arise? Often from sitting in the midst of our deepest pain, dukkha states. You know, and we find as awareness moves through and, you know, discovers what I've been calling the more subtle body, the tides and the currents and the streaming and the flows and pulsation, we find these blocks or find these holes in which the approach is simply to notice, to be present, not to change or fix, not to even want it to be different, you know, but we discover in that gap, in that hole, whatever it may be, and there may be at first no other experience around it, no images or emotions. It would just be a kind of numbness or an emotional blankness. It just feels like a hole in our body energy field. And awareness simply notices that, maybe for some time. You know? But after a while, some link is made, some sense of a disconnection, some sense of, this is a frozen area or a forgotten area or a contracted area. But still, it's just to be noticed. The Dhamma has its own agenda, and no will or intention other than just being present will make anything happen, will make that hole go away or, you know, fill it necessarily with understanding. Instead, it's just an experience, you know, a body whole, rich in the process of healing. Even if that hole, and some of our holes, we may have for life, they may always be there. You know, if we can accept that, that some of our patterns, some of our wounding may always be there, even up to full enlightenment, it helps let go that, you know, that struggle of trying to fix anything. It's just a place that where we don't feel connection, but we feel enough connection with the rest of our body, and there is an understanding, you know, that this hole is there. There's a break in the connection and the mind-body unity field, but it doesn't have to be perfect, this mind-body unity energy field. We're not looking for that kind of perfection here. The body is never going to be perfect, you know, and our emotional life will never be perfect. There's a story of a Sri Lankan monk who, before he was enlightened, he was in the habit of calling everyone a name that meant something like jackass. And it was from a place of inflation and, you know, arrogance. His attendant, anyone that he felt above, and he felt above just about everyone, was a jackass. And then he was enlightened, fully enlightened, no longer any residue of ill will or greed, you know, arrogance, all conceit, all gone. But it's said in the Buddhist mythology that for 500 lifetimes, he had been in the habit of calling people jackass. So he still called them jackass, but there was no ill will. We're not looking for perfect personalities. Thank God. We become aware, you know, of these different layers, holes, stackings, and whatnot. It's enough. And some of them will open. Some will become available for reintegration or transformation. We could see our path as this interlocking, again, a mutual connection or interconnectedness of both transformation and transcendence. And the work of transformation is indeed, you know, having healthier personalities through the practice of metta and, you know, resourcing, using our mindfulness for just healthier bodies, more clearly thinking minds to feel ourselves in life as intimately connected with everything. The compassion practices, you know, all the Brahma-Vihara practices, filling our lives with more joy and just, you know, having a healthy sense of ourself, healthy khanda, you know, healthy physical form and the feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness. And it's of great value because we live interrelatedly. This is the human condition. This is the samsaric condition. All of us live in relation, in relationship with everyone and everything else. So the work of transformation is essential. It's a really important part of our practice. It's here where we gather our confidence and courage and the quality of mindfulness that is more and more conjoined with wisdom, the power of stillness and wisdom to live this life. Transcendence, on the other hand, is like the goal of the island in mind that we want to pull out of the sea. Transcendence is concerned with beyond personality. Transcendence is concerned with beyond life and death. It's that sense that faith may reveal, and the Dhamma, courage, energy, may reveal more and more awareness, wisdom, that there is more than life and death, this wheel of life and death. And sometimes it's enough for us to see that the epicenter of samsara, the wheel of life and death, is in our own mind, and we get a good sense of that. That it's in each moment. Each moment we, you know, create the world, either with clarity or, you know, are skewed by our concepts. But it is that, you know, engine of craving and ignorance that keep it running. So as we see that and sense that, with faith and wisdom, you know, we can infer that maybe this is how it is indeed. Maybe there is that which is beyond. And the two are really important because the transcendence anchors us more in the anatta consciousness, you know, the consciousness of not referring experience back to any self, that emptiness. And therefore, the work we do in transformation is more pure. You know, we can indeed have moments of being utterly free of unskillfulness. that childlike awareness that places the hermit crab in the lap of the Buddha. But these are our resources. You know, the Eightfold Path is a resource. Eightfold Path is a conditioned thing. You know, it's a samsaric thing. Eightfold Path being our practice of mindfulness, sila, samadhi, punya. But the Buddha said it's the best of all conditioned things. Eightfold Path is conditioned phenomena, but the best of all conditioned phenomena, because it is that which leads to the end of conditioned phenomena. It is the karma that leads to the end of karma. So we practice it to make it our own. You know, we practice it to be the Eightfold Path, to be sila, to be metta and compassion, to be this mindful presence, moment to moment, to be wisdom. It's the path, ultimately, then, of our own making. And the Buddha's discovery of it was not because of the Buddha. Whether or not there are Buddhas, the Dhamma is, the truth is. In times where it's forgotten, someone comes around. Usually just in time, you know, and rediscovers what is. And then offers it to us. So I introduced in the beginning, there's these cycles. It may be going really well for a while, may experiencing a lot of peace or equanimity, insights, joy. You know, we feel maybe we've mastered fear or anger. Done with that. And then guess what? Wake up in the morning and, you know, what's happened? It could be something as simple as a change in weather. Buddha talked about four conditions that affect the body. Weather, food, consciousness, meaning our mental states, emotions, and karma. Karma being our moment-to-moment experience of pleasant or unpleasant, our neutral feeling. You know, that can have an effect. And if our energy is low, you know, our confidence is lagging, we may just spin out on what's just like a bad hair day, you know, a bad mood, where it's not, you know, like that long 3-hour sitting I had yesterday. Where'd that go? And, you know, and we can often respond with a healthy kind of awareness, know it's going to pass, still know that even though we feel now completely disconnected from ourselves and from everything else around us and from the Dhamma, that we can resource somewhere. We can find a place to anchor our awareness. Maybe it's the metta that we all found as a resource pool in the first days of the retreat. Maybe it's a walk in nature, a change in pace. Change the object of our awareness. Change the anchor. Recall a time, either in this retreat or another one, where it was very deeply peaceful, insightful, connected. You know, not in way of longing, but as a resource, in a way of mirroring, in a way of remembering, a way of holding that perspective, reconnecting with the vision of the island. Even sweeping through the body and finding those tides and currents that flow around those holes, empty places, sense of disconnection, can be a resource. Anything that keeps a sense of present time awareness is a resource. You know, anything that helps prevent the mind from proliferating into strong reactivity, judgment, criticism, where we get lost, we lose the plot. It can be such a resource. It's simply the need, you know, to protect our practice, the sense of setting up strong boundaries. You'd think of the four pillars of the four spiritual emotions of metta, compassion, joy, and equanimity, you know, going from one to the other as protective pillars, supports around us, and resource them. Because you've had those moments of pure metta. You've felt compassion for someone or from someone. You have felt those moments of joy for someone or from someone. You've had that equanimity of non-reactivity in the mind, where things are just as they are. It's okay. It's totally okay to be there. I think patience has been spoken of, but you know, here in these moments, to look for the spaces between the reactive mind. When the reactive mind is happening, you know, it will intrude even upon our resources. We'll have to go through it. There's a spin out that may happen for part of a day or for a few days. So some of you are coming in now and feeling, gee, I've lost it, you know. How do I get back? How do I find that place again where it was okay, even though it was painful? Now it's just, you know, like a small itch, and I, you know, I jump out of my seat and want to go home. It's just like, where's that peace? That very sense or judgment of regression is often a sign or a signal of progression, in fact. There are insight precursors, that is, little signs and symbols physically, mentally, before some of the deeper insights, which have exactly the signs that it's not happening anymore. I've lost mindfulness. Can't find energy. Can't find the breath. Can't find the body. Can't find any object. You know, the mind's just spun out. It's on a roller coaster. And you want to, as they say, roll up the mat and go home. And that's why we're here. Say it's okay. That this will not only pass, but that this is an important place to find those little spaces between. Acceptance, the word, the kanti, the word for patience, another meaning is accepting what is arising in this moment. The acceptance of either what's desirable or undesirable. We may like it, we may dislike it. But kanti is the allowing of it. Acceptance, this is what's here. And it starts to grow a little space in those reactive moments when the mind's proliferating, you know, saying we can't do it. Michelle and I came back to Hawaii once after a retreat. It was 10 years ago. And my dad, you know, who was still alive then, used to love to pick us up at the airport. And he came out in our new car, the only new car we've ever had. And parked it. Those days, you could park it in front of where you come out from baggage. And as is the custom in Hawaii, you offer lei to your people who come home or your guests who come to Hawaii. And so he put lei around Michelle, gave her a hug and a kiss, and then he grabbed her luggage cart. And then he had another lei for me. And so he started to give me the lei and couldn't quite get it around my head, so he let go of the luggage cart and went careening right into the car. made a big dent in the back. Not a big dent, a little dent, but to me it was a real big dent. It was a massive dent. And like my dad, he said, "Oh, whenever you see that, you'll think of me." So once I got over reactive mind, I found that it was true. And at first, I would remember him with reactive mind. But today, I revere that, you know, what we might call a flaw, as a jewel. I'll probably never be able to sell this car. We watch these mind states, you know, to come and go. Try to create enough space, patience. In the text, often give an image of, even if your anger is as large as the largest ocean, you know, boiling, then make patience or patient awareness like the shore that surrounds that ocean. Make it bigger than the anger or fear. You know, then it's not going to dominate. It's not, and it's just it's a big mental state, but not a permanent one, and not damaging. You know, if our awareness is bigger than these difficult mental states, then it's not going to increase the reactivity, the patterning, the habits in our body or our mind. And just quite to the contrary, the larger we can handle the most difficult emotions, the deeper our equanimous mindfulness grows. And the habitual patterns that so easily intrude, you know, they could become they become understood on an intuitive level by awareness. Oh, okay, this is a big pattern. You know, the more intense an emotion, sometimes the more intense a body, a Dhamma pain, you know, that has no other reason to be there, the more it is something really old, an old karmic knot and tangle. And the only reason for it to be there is to be felt, to be part of our healing, of our teaching, to be part of our liberation. No other reason. It'll never be figured out conceptually. In the sutta, we've been reading Satipatthana Sutta, she or he abides contemplating the mind, diligent, clearly knowing and mindful, free from desires and discontent in regard to the world. Free from desires and discontent. These are the moments of rest, of resourcing. These are the moments when we're not being reactive. These are the moments when the mind isn't going after pleasant or repelling pain, what I often call bamboo mind. You know, its very strength is in its perceived vulnerability, its emptiness, its hollowness, its ability to be so supple, yielding, that even in hurricanes in the tropics in Asia, it'll bend this way, it'll bend that way, but its nature is to come back to center. That's what the non-reactive mind of equanimity is. You know, it may bend toward what's alluring. It may bend back away from what's unlikable, painful. But it wants to stay centered, and often it will. It often will just be unmoving in the face of whatever formations, physical or mental, and whatever their texture, pleasant or unpleasant, desirable and undesirable. So regardless of our judgments about what might be happening in our practice, there's such a transparency going on now. And You know, Michelle and I were talking earlier about so many of you come in just glowing. The power of the practice to bring about clear eyes and bright complexion and just this shine, this glow. And yet you'll sit down and think it's really going bad. You know, we almost want to laugh because we're in fact, you know, basking in your glow of awareness. And, you know, you just can't measure. You cannot compare. Just impossible, because it's only a memory in the mind of how it might have been. It's just another cycle where mindfulness is, you know, skipping some beats. And old habits are intruding for a while. You just need to find a way to make, you know, make space around it. Understand that it will indeed change. Get encouragement. You know, that's what we're here for. Encourage yourself or you know, ask the teachers, as you have been, kind of what's going on. The more you can let go of measuring, of comparing, you know, of remembering, of projecting, and just be with the process, really trust the process, then you can escape optional dukkha. Dukkha you don't need. You might be going through, you know, a dukkha dip where it is indeed another layer of stuff being lifted up for the very reason of the success of your practice. Transparency, being so clear, seeing things so clearly, seeing through things so clearly, seeing through the conceptual overlay and whatnot. And, you know, we just lose perspective when that dip comes. So, you know, optional dukkha is then dumping on ourselves, whipping ourselves. I've lost it. I can't do it. But I'll say it again. It's often precursor experience where mindfulness isn't working well. You know, and all we can do is just patiently bear with it and bring in as much mindful attention as we can, particularly to the difficulty that's happening, you know, or a resource. The more you can be, you know, and just go through with the awareness, knowing mind and whatever is difficult, you're going to cut through a lot of that measure, comparing, judgment, because watching the mind, it's just no space for that interpretive mind, conceptual mind, thinking mind to get in there. It's too quick. You know, it's a good time, except when you need to drop the labeling and just feel the flow and texture of mental states coming and going. See if you can just relax enough to bring attention to that knowing mind. Mindfully knowing mind. And often some of the corners get illumined, some of the places where, you know, those patterns are sort of hovering, waiting to pounce on experience and cause the mind to think and compare and judge and so forth. The more we let ourselves feel the dukkha, again, as I said before, the more we begin to feel what's really important. This body is in decay. You know, this body is in change. So yeah, it's nice to ride those planes where it's all come together for a while. And everything, you know, is fit. There's this unity of mind, body, awareness. It's just a flow. We feel in the current of the Dhamma. We feel carried by the Dhamma. But conditions change. For a while, we will be reactive. We can go through that and find those spaces, those resources, and patience. The conditions for the reactivity will go away. The conditions for the dukkha will go away. You know, and again, a new layer will arise. Things will feel like they come back together again. You can't have one without the other. You know, we only know what's important, and we only know that pure, deep desire, you know, for what is good, what is Dhamma, to the depth that we allow ourselves to go into dukkha. The difficult. The Buddha's direct teaching. One of them is to do with the mind, watching the mind, to know whether the mind is at this moment forgetful or collected, present. If we did nothing else, you know, throughout our lives, this is really profound practice. Our teacher Upandita used to really stress how significant and important it is to notice the absences, you know, to notice how the frequency with which we're forgetful, the frequency with which mindfulness isn't here, isn't present. And doing that increases mindfulness. That honest, you know, piercing insight and recognition of a mind moment without awareness and the mind moments with mindful awareness has extreme repercussions on our entire mind-body understanding, and not cause for giving up. It's the cause for really appreciating those jewel moments of awareness, of presence. There's a poem from William Stafford. If you don't know the kind of person I am, and I don't know the kind of person you are, a pattern that other made may prevail in the world, and following the wrong God home, we may miss our star. Sometimes I'd like to read these twice. If you don't know the kind of person I am, and I don't know the kind of person you are, a pattern that other made may prevail in the world, and following the wrong God home, we may miss our star. For there is many a small betrayal in the mind, a shrug that lets the fragile sequence break, sending with shouts the horrible errors of childhood, storming out to play through the broken dike. For it is important that awake people be awake, or a breaking line may discourage them back to sleep. For it is important that awake people be awake, or a breaking line may discourage them back to sleep. The signals we give, yes or no or maybe, should be clear. The darkness around us is deep. But as we get a little more masterful at understanding, you know, the changing weather systems, the turbulent system, and, you know, sometimes it's smooth sailing, and sometimes the winds change, the currents change, and it's more challenged to work with that, and we have to be very adaptable, very flexible, ready for anything, and, you know, reactive mind slips back in, You know, okay, then it's chaos for a while, but we try to find those spaces between reactive mind, infusing them with patience, with acceptance, resourcing where we can, through the body, through our anchor, through sounds, through metta, whatever it takes, and find a rest, a mindful resting place. Every moment we're mindful, it's a rest from concepts. Concepts take a lot of energy to keep our world constructed. It takes a lot of mental energy and physical energy, you know, to hold the world in the habitual way we do, which is why it's scary at first, but ultimately really relieving when everything seems to be dissolving. You know, everything seems to be falling away, because that's a major rest from concepts, from conceptual form. Concepts hide reality. Resting in reality is peace. It's joy. It's not always pleasant, but it's true. And because it's true, because it's truth, we feel connected. We feel home. We feel okay. This is how things are. And more aware, we see all the causes and effects. You know, when we rush around mentally, when we rush around physically, we notice how other mental states are affected by that. Restlessness may arise, doubts may arise, you know, aversion may arise. And then if we call forth calm, you know, and stop that mental rushing or curtail it, you know, redirect the energy of it into the flow of the moment, then it's like, oh, there's the breath again. There's the moment. You notice that. We've come back. Again, it's that question, where is awareness? Is this a moment of forgetfulness or a moment of remembering, of being present, being awake? We rush physically around. We realize how that has that's the cause for similar effects in the mind. It makes the mind feel rushed or maybe agitated or uneasy, or we may not even see the pattern erupt, but we find ourselves suddenly back into striving rather than relaxing. Forgetful that this practice moves most smoothly when we're so relaxed that the practice itself is doing the work. We feel carried by the Dhamma. Some of these deeper layers open up and we feel suddenly we don't know where we are. You know, that's part of when conditions change and we're looking around for that awareness or that peacefulness, that calm. But we're in new terrain all of a sudden, you know, kind of lost perspective. And you know, here we might be called upon to rest in uncertainty, rest in the unknown, to allow where we're being carried to unfold, not needing to know what's happening. And why often, you know, your teachers will say, trust the process. Giving you information, even if it's accurate, can get in the way. You know, you use that mental information to lose connection and therefore cadence with how the Dhamma is working through you. The very last important completion, I'd say, for the Hokulea, this 60-foot double hull canoe, that first journey to Tahiti and the Marquesas in 1975, 25 years later, 2000, during the three-month retreat, they completed the last leg of what's called the Polynesian Triangle, with Hawaii being the northern point and New Zealand the southern point. But they needed to wait for 25 years to make this last, most treacherous journey to Rapa Nui, known as Easter Island. It required the most skill. And the people on that crew were women and men who had been, most of them, sailing for 25 years. Those early journeys had a lot of conflict, a lot of personality clashes and arguments. And you read the National Geographic version, and you think, I'm glad I wasn't on that boat. You know, it was horrible for Mao Pialog, the Micronesian master. He just wanted nothing to do with the crew. He wanted to jump off and swim back to Micronesia. So he'd just go under the tarp and just stay out of it. So it was a lot of growing of community, a lot of relearning of aloha, you know, metta in the heart. So this very last journey, we had Nainoa over for tea one afternoon. And Michelle and I had submitted his name for an award from the His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, which was accepted. And so he just came to thank us and get this letter. And he just finished this journey, which he said was the most powerful of all. All these skilled crew people. And, you know, unlike the other journeys, there was just a lot of stillness, he said. You know, when they figured out they were on course, or even when they finally saw Rapa Nui, neither a lot of elation nor disappointment, just a lot of evenness, centeredness, equanimity, people working together. The most spiritual of all the trips, he said, they felt really guided inwardly, you know, because it was, Rapa Nui is so far away from everything that it's really a needle in a haystack kind of thing, and you really have to be on, because they never used any other instruments, you know, but the elemental mapping of the sky and the currents, turbulent systems, you know. And finally, one morning, it was the youngest navigator, a grandson of Mao's, you know, and Nainoa was one of three or four navigators, you know. He was acting more as captain, and then another navigator, and then apprentice ones. And he's looking at this cloud formation, you know, way off in the distance, and watching it, and looked at his crew and said, "No, you know, that's not it." And this young kid, fresh eyes, just he kept watching it. And he said, "You know, we pulled it out of the sea. That's it. That's Rapa Nui." And I know I said, "No. No, it's not." You know, and then finally one of the other navigators, in watching this young one watch what he was watching, got it. That it wasn't a cloud formation. It was a 1,600-foot peak, you know, of the tallest hill, mountain, on Rapa Nui. He grabbed Nainoa's, you know, ankle, who was standing up on the gunwales, and said, "We're home, brother." You know, and the young navigator was right. He saw that this indeed was the island. He said it was trust and friendship that were the guiding forces of that journey. Deep trust and friendship had guided them on this most difficult, dangerous leg. Of course, they're still sailing now, but that was the completion of an era, a quarter of a century journey back to their origins. I want to end with a poem by Mary Oliver called Luna. And this has to do with what I said the other morning, that our practice is really about doing nothing with full commitment. It's about being a rebel against our habitual ways. Luna is the name for this moth. In the early curtains of the dusk, it flew, a slow galloping, this way and that way, through the trees and under the trees. I live in the open-mindedness of not knowing enough about anything. It was beautiful. It was silent. It didn't even have a mouth, but it wanted something. It had a purpose and a few precious hours to find it. And I suppose it did. The next evening, it lay on the ground like a broken leaf and didn't move, which hurt my heart, which is another small thing that doesn't know much. When this happened, it was about the middle of summer, which also has its purposes and only so many precious hours. How quietly, and not with any assignment from us, or even a small hint of understanding. Everything that needs to be done is done. How quietly, and not with any assignment from us, or even a small hint of understanding, everything that needs to be done is done.